You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
The following podcast contains a bit of explicit material, but much, much more that is not explicit, just as a percentage. It's Wednesday, January 17th, 2018. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And the rankings from Freedom House are out. Freedom House, turn it up, dude. This is the house, not a house, more of an organization that tells you which countries are the freest. The United States comes in at a solid 86. That is a B student. Last year was an 89, a B-plus student, trending down. We are the shining city on the hill. Not at like 75 lumens, more like 55, but, you know, it's pretty shining. Same amount of shine as Poland. Norway's at 100. Uruguay is 98. Seems high for Uruguay. Here's my analysis there. They had that president, Mujica. He's out now, legalized marijuana, total hippie. It was like having Ben and Jerry as the president. If Ben and Jerry did jail time for fighting against dictators, and no, naming your first ice cream Tricky Dicky Crunch does not count, though, you know, a solid dig, Ben and Jerry. Here's my theory about Uruguay and their great ranking. You really value your freedoms when you just live through a dictatorship. So from 73 to 85, they were run by a dictatorship. People would disappear, a lot of killing of the opposition. So these days, you know, people are really reading the news hard, making sure the freedoms don't slip away. Government could lift a finger, kind of implying, you know, we could go there, and the population responds in kind. The United States takes it more for granted. But this isn't really about the United States slipping. This is more, I've pointed this out before, but I really want to underline this one ranking. It's not at the top. It's not Norway or the United States, which is doing good as a B. It's near the bottom. Syria is a minus one. We all understand that. North Korea is, I think, a 3 or a 4. But Saudi Arabia is a 7. Saudi Arabia is our great, great ally. Iran has a rating of 17. 17 is more than double. Saudi Arabia could double the freedom and it wouldn't even reach Iran. Would you rather be middle class in Iran or Saudi Arabia? Kind of a stupid question. There is no middle class in Saudi Arabia. You'd much rather live in Iran. You really would. Maybe you don't want to be upper class in Iran. That's pretty sweet in Saudi Arabia. You get to be a prince, buy a yacht on spec. What's being upper class in Iran? You probably have to, you know, kiss the ass of a mullah or at least have ties to the Revolutionary Guard. You have to pretty much kill people. A Saudi prince can live a life of leisure. But there's only a couple thousand of them. Actually, too many. It's one of the reasons the kingdom has a rating of 7. 7 is really bad, right? We could beat ourselves up as Americans for being in league with some bad countries or some countries that are less than great. Nigeria, a lot of problems. We got to do deals with them because of Boko Haram. There are 50. Even Pakistan, right? Terrible terrorism supporting Pakistan, Trump administration waving a finger at Pakistan. They're 43. It's light years ahead of Saudi Arabia. The United States is doubly as free as Pakistan. Pakistan is, I don't know, what's the word for more than 6 times, sextuply as free as Saudi Arabia. So that is my point. Saudi Arabia is a 7, just so you know. Be so advised. On the show today, I spiel about an aspect of Washington, D.C. that's just not as fun as it used to be. It's the dysfunction, the horrible dysfunction. But first, I don't know, maybe you thought that Tom Cruise was giving up on Jack Reacher and moving into a new franchise. No, that's not who Max Boot is. He's not a fictional character. But he is something different or someone different than who you thought he was. He was one of the leading lights of conservatism. Now he's a never Trump. He might be a liberal, but he's also an expert on Vietnam. We'll talk to him about all that. We'll be right back.
podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
I've been reading Max Boot probably since the early 2000s. He wrote in the Wall Street Journal. He wrote for the Weekly Standard. And I always said to myself, well, here's a guy who's a conservative, obviously very smart. We disagree on a lot of things, but I think he marshals his arguments well. And in his books, including one I read called The Savage Wars of Peace, which is really about America's small wars, you get the sense, in fact, you see the evidence that he's a student, a real student of history. He's out with a new book now. And also, maybe we could talk about, should I still define him as a conservative with whom I disagree? The new book is The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam. Hello, Max.
Hi.
So Lansdale was, if people did know him, they probably knew him incorrectly as the inspiration for Graham Greene's Quiet American. Is this how you knew him first?
Well, that's certainly the legend of Edward Lansdale as the inspiration for the Quiet American, as the inspiration for one of the main characters in The Ugly American. And he was at one time, you know, really a legendary figure who was written about by David Halberstam, Neil Sheehan, Francis Fitzgerald. Every writer who wrote about Vietnam wrote about Edward Lansdale. But what happened is that as I got into writing this book about him, I found that a lot of the stuff that was written about him was just not accurate, that people had not had access to the kind of documentary record that I was able to get my hands on, including the letters that he wrote not only to his wife, but also to his longtime mistress, this Filipino lady who eventually became his second wife, as along with all these newly declassified documents. And that all of that together really enables me to portray Lansdale in the fullest and most in-depth terms that has been possible to date, and to provide a much more rounded picture of his exploits in the Philippines and Vietnam.
The highest rank he achieved was what?
He actually retired as a two-star general. He was probably the least likely general in the whole history of the Air Force, or probably any other service, because he wasn't a pilot, he wasn't a navigator, he wasn't a conventional intelligence officer. He was really a covert operative, and in some ways his field was psychological operations and a cultural understanding, and that's really what he focused on, was understanding the Philippines and Vietnam in order to influence those societies. And that's not a skill set that's routinely cultivated by the Air Force or by any other military service.
And this was a time when a CIA or OSS operative, they'd usually come from the Ivy League schools. They'd join such a service as an act of noblesse oblige. But he wasn't like that. That wasn't his background.
No, he wasn't. I mean, people joked that OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, actually stood for Oh So Social, because there were so many upper crust individuals. And that wasn't him at all. He was not like the wise men who made U.S. foreign policy. He didn't go to an Ivy League school. He didn't go to a white shoe law firm in New York. He was a middle-class kid. His father was this automotive executive who had a lot of ups and downs in his career. Ed Lansdale grew up in California, went to a public school, went to UCLA, dropped out of UCLA at the height of the Great Depression, moved to New York hoping to become a New Yorker writer or cartoonist. Didn't quite work out. Instead, he got into advertising and had a fairly successful advertising career in San Francisco when World War II broke out. And then, you know, he wanted to enlist, he wanted to do his bid, and so he got into the OSS and eventually moved into the Army and the Air Force and then the CIA, and that's how he launched his career as a secret agent.
Why was his orientation, what about his upbringing or his personality, made him see the person rather than the enemy?
That's a great question, because he grew up in California at a time in the 1920s when there was virulent racism, especially against Asian Americans. I mean, we excluded Asian Americans at that time. And there were all sorts of negative stereotypes about Chinese and Koreans and others. And for whatever reason, Ed Lansdale was never susceptible to that prejudice. He always grew up seeing Asians and everybody else as just ordinary people. And, you know, combing through his letters and his papers, I really saw no evidence of any kind of racial animus of the kind that was so routine at that time. And I think that was significant. It was also significant that he was not a great student, but he loved reading about the Founding Fathers. He loved the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. He was really enamored of the ideals contained in those documents. And the final thing that I would mention is that his family was Christian Scientists. And, you know, if you know anything about Christian Science, you know it's really a religion that puts mind over matter, that really believes that with the right willpower and the right belief set, you can really transform yourself and transform the world. And I think that was also very important in shaping Ed Lansdale to believe that he could change these Asian societies.
So you found his love letters, and the reason that he was engaged in this, well, I don't know why it started, the 10-year affair, but his wife wouldn't grant him a divorce, essentially. Perhaps it has the sheen of scandal, but in modern times, he would say the first marriage didn't work out, and then he'd have a second marriage.
Right, and he, in fact, talked about getting a divorce, but his wife wouldn't grant it, and he couldn't push it through, and so he stayed married. But, you know, I really thought that the relationship that he had with Pat Kelly, this Philippine war widow that he met when he went to the Philippines in 1945, was incredibly important for him, not only emotionally and personally, but also professionally. And that, and this is a part of the Ed Lansdale story that's never been told before, because, you know, when he wrote his memoir in 1972, his first wife was still alive, so there was no mention of Pat Kelly, who was arguably the most important person in his life. And she is somebody who really served as a guide for him in the Philippines, because she came from the part of the Philippines where the communist insurgents, the Hawks, were located in Luzon province. And she guided him around there to those areas. But she served not just as a tour guide, but really as a cultural guide. She was an interpreter of Filipino culture. She gave him a way to really understand Filipinos in a way that very few outsiders possibly could. And that, in turn, set up his success in defeating the Hawk Rebellion.
Was he one of the best and the brightest? I mean, best and the brightest is an ironic, derisive title for the people who bungled into the war.
Definitely not. In fact, he was constantly at odds with the best and brightest. In fact, his career ended in the Kennedy administration because he was telling unpleasant truths to the best and brightest, such as Robert McNamara, the former CEO of the Ford Motor Company, who became Secretary of Defense and called Lansdale into his office one day. McNamara had this graph paper in front of him, and he said, you know, Ed, I'm trying to come up with some mathematical equations that will help me understand what's going on in Vietnam, and I'd like you to help me out, and so that we can put into the computer and we can come up with some solid answers.
Because he was in charge of GM.
He looked
at Ford
Motor
like
Company. McNamara loved numbers. He thought there was truth in numbers. And Lansdale, who was this, you know, UCLA dropout, had never gone to the Harvard Business School, was not this mathematical genius like Robert McNamara, said to him, "Oh, you know, Mr. Secretary, I'm happy to help you, but don't forget the X factor." And McNamara starts writing X factor on his graph paper and says, okay, what is that? How do you compute that? And Lansdale said, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Secretary, you can't compute it. The X factor is the feelings of the population. And that is ultimately what is going to determine the outcome of the war in Vietnam. And of course, McNamara, being McNamara, instead of taking Lansdale's wisdom to heart, concluded he was an idiot who didn't understand the higher mathematics that McNamara had mastered, and ushered him out of the office and cut him off from influence on Vietnam policy, even though in hindsight, it's obvious that Lansdale had a much more sophisticated understanding of what was going on than people like McNamara, who tried to, who in their arrogance as the best and brightest, tried to impose this very superficial understanding on the situation. You know, Westmoreland and others were very simplistic and arrogant, and believed that you could basically kill the Viet Cong faster than they could be replaced. And Lansdale always said, no, that's not going to work. You're not going to kill these insurgents and make them disappear. The only way you're going to win this war is politically. You have to outgovern the insurgents. They have an idea. You have to have a better idea. You have to foster a government that the people will support. You know, the people of Vietnam have really paid the highest price of all for the kind of government that they've had.
The problem with sending a Lansdale-esque delegation to a country, up until a year ago, you could say, look, we're representing the ideals of the United States, where we're here to tell you that the United States backs you. Here is our proof. But now, when the executive of the United States is Donald Trump, the assurances ring hollow. If I was the leader of another country, I wouldn't necessarily believe a delegation saying, we're here to work with you, we're not here to bomb you.
Well, exactly, especially if you happen to be a leader of a shithole country, quote unquote, as labeled by President Trump. I mean, I think, you know, Trump is doing more damage to American soft power just in the last year than
he doesn't believe in it. He doesn't believe we have soft power.
Well, and
he's totally ignorant.
And he's completely dispelling it. And he is allowing us to lose the moral high ground. You know, I know if Ed Lansdale were still around, he would have been outraged and deeply saddened, because he always thought, Ed Lansdale always thought, that America's most powerful weapon was the ideals in our Declaration of Independence. He thought that those had appeal that could rival the appeal of the Communist Manifesto and, you know, the works that communist cadres tried to spread around Asia. And he really tried to act, I should add, in a very humble, empathetic way. And that was a lot of his success in places like the Philippines and Vietnam is that he wasn't bombastic. He didn't lecture. He listened to people. He treated them as equals. You know, the words of the Declaration of Independence ring hollow today when we have a president who does not believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all.
How you understood Vietnam, did that influence your opinion about whether the United States should engage in war in Iraq?
Well, I think my understanding of both Iraq and Vietnam has evolved over the years. I would say that in 2003, when I, along with many other people, were supportive of the invasion of Iraq, I probably had more confidence than was warranted in the ability of the United States to impose change at gunpoint in a country like this. And obviously, subsequent events have shown the folly of our ways. In studying at Lansdale, I think, has made me somewhat more realistic and measured about the uses of American military power, because Ed Lansdale was somebody who, going back to the 1950s, was very skeptical that we could achieve all these grandiose results through just pure application of military power through bombs and bullets. He very early on saw the importance of politics and government and all these other things that are very hard to influence from the outside. And, you know, I wish in hindsight I had been more cognizant of those hard-won truths in the case of Iraq.
So you just mentioned you re-examined the lessons, you've thought about different ways to think. You came out with this well-regarded piece saying 2017 was the year that you began to understand your white privilege. How was that piece of, I guess, liberalism on a social level tied into the very vocal anti-Trump stance that you've taken, which was, I think, mostly based on international politics?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's, in fairness, I've been concerned about that since day one when he, you know, came down the escalator at Trump Tower and started attacking Mexican Americans. That to me was outrageous that that was tolerated. And, you know, you see now where that's led, where, you know, he's sitting in the White House and denouncing quote unquote shithole countries. You know, I came here as an immigrant in 1976 from the Soviet Union at age 7, and I tend to have a fairly starry-eyed view, I would say, of the United States as the land of opportunity, which, you know, I think it still is. But I think in hindsight, I blinded myself to some of the dark strains in our country and imagined we had made more progress than we'd actually made. And I think it was a combination of things in the last year or two that's really opened my eyes, including the open racism of Donald Trump and the fact that a lot of his voters either like that or don't think it's disqualifying, and it ought to be disqualifying. And also, of course, the Me Too phenomenon with all these stories that we now read of how women have been abused. And also the final piece of it, all these videotapes that show how police officers have abused African Americans and other minorities. All this stuff is pretty troubling. I mean, I think we're still basically a good country and better than most, but there are some deeply troubling strains here, and you know, I just can't close my eyes to those.
Do you think part of this, it's hard to assess, but is there anything to you being in a certain, I'm not going to say bubble, but you wrote for conservative publications, you were the Gene Kirkpatrick chair, you were in the Council of Foreign Relations, which is right and left and everything else, you're definitely a public intellectual, but was part of it, I talked to a lot of people who talk about the reason we have opinions are so often that we're trying to, you know, reinforce our social status. Is there anything to it there? Once you broke with the right, you were maybe freer to say, okay, what else don't I believe?
Yeah, I think that's actually a very perceptive comment. That's exactly how I feel. I feel like for a lot of years I was in this ideological bubble, and I wasn't focused on most of these issues. I've always been a foreign policy wonk and national security, and I've kind of gone along for the ride on these other issues. I didn't really focus on them, and, you know, people on the right, whatever they say, I, you know, fine, whatever.
Yeah.
But now that I've kind of broken decisively with Trump and the Republican Party, I'm no longer a Republican. I don't really write for conservative publications anymore. I'm really more of a free agent, and it's really a liberating experience after you know, more than 40 years on this earth, to really, I think for myself and not have to worry about what my fellow travelers think of me or what my boss thinks of me, but just to really think through these issues and realize, wait a second, some of the stuff that I went along with before was wrong, and I shouldn't have done it.
In terms of racism or white privilege, what was... Is the phrase white privilege just make everyone laugh and so they don't actually consider it? Yeah. I'm trying to get specific and tangible about what is something you didn't consider.
Well, I think I kind of just tended to go along with the kind of the common arguments that conservatives make to denigrate the importance of these issues and, you know, basically to attack political correctness and suggest that's the real problem. It's not the underlying racism or sexism. and to argue, you know, things have gotten much better than they used to be, which is, you know, no doubt true. We don't have slavery. We don't have segregation.
Yeah.
So things have been worse in the past. But, you know, that's not an excuse for how bad things may be today in certain areas. And I think we need to acknowledge that. And that's something that I've been forced to acknowledge in the last couple of years.
Max Boot. By the way, is Max Boot your real name?
My one and only, yes.
Really?
Yes.
You were in Russia. You were known as Max Boot.
Yes. And he's spelled with Cyrillic characters. And my name was originally Maxim, so I dropped the IM, but yeah.
That is awesome. Max Boot is the author of The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale, and the American Tragedy in Vietnam. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And now the spiel. I like politics. You like politics. I think you like politics. That's why you listen to me. But you know what I hate? I hate this.
Without at least a short-term spending bill, the federal government will shut down on Friday.
And Republicans have a new short-term plan to keep the government funded. Short-term plan.
It's a short-term continuing resolution
that will keep the government funded only for another 28 days until February 16th.
We're talking about the short-term stopgap of a CR or continuing resolution.
What is this new teeny tiny short-term plan?
Oh, man, I hate the emergency funding bill. To avert a shutdown, I just hate it. I mean, it's better than an actual shutdown. But the whole rigmarole and the deadlines and the process, and then they get the deal and they announce, well, it's not a great deal, but the press conference is, you know, kind of painted as a little bit of progress. It's not what I got into the game for. You know what I'm saying? Why do I like politics? Why do I cover politics? If I want to be high-minded and extremely self-deceptive, I would say it's because I care about people and my fellow countrymen and the direction that we're going. And I do. I do. It's not why I care about politics. If you really care about those things, that means you care about policy. And I definitely care about some policies, many policies. But if you care about policies, trying to figure out and study policies through the prism of politics is really ineffective. Like, let's say you care about fisheries. I'm gonna read up on fisheries and get to know about fisheries, but I'm gonna let Ryan Zinke be my guide. It's a huge waste of time. Let's say your passion is healthcare. Then you should read Atul Gawande. He'll sometimes talk about politics, but he'll tell you about amazing cutting-edge things that are going on in the world of healthcare. He'll tell you some disturbing things that are going on in the world of healthcare. If you tune in to the House Ways and Means Committee to figure out about healthcare, you are wasting your time. What about democracy? Do I care about politics? Because I do so love democracy. I'll tell you. Following U.S. politics out of a love for democracy is like being a fan of the rodeo because you like animals. Yeah, it's similar. The rodeo needs animals. American politics needs democracy. But each is pretty abusive of that fundamental aspect of their enterprise. What about personalities? I'm just compelled by the personalities. The Jeff Flakes. The Ben Cardins. Yeah, Hollywood's a lot better for that, isn't it? And reality TV, which used to be a little bit separate from politics. I will tell you why I like it. It's a little of what I said, elements of what I said, but all the stuff I said, what that really does is combine to heighten the stakes. The stakes are real. I really like the arguments. Not the shithole, shithouse, shithead arguments, but two sides of an idea. And that idea is not esoteric. It's practical. The ideas sometimes get put into effect or not. I like thinking about the ideas and arguing about the ideas and figuring out why other people think what they think about the ideas. I really like changing my mind about the ideas. I'm also curious and fascinated by bad ideas. That stupid wall that no one says will work. Why are people for that? I want to know. I'm compelled. Anytime most of the people have a bad idea, some of me is like, well, maybe I could do something to convince them otherwise. But I also really want to, why are most people in favor of the death tax? That is fascinating. That's part of politics. Then there are the times when the people, are against a policy and politics still want that policy to go through. when an extremely unpopular act like the tax bill passes. That's compelling, too. It says something about the institution, the body politic, that has mutated to form this thing that no one wanted in the first place. You want to study a mutation. It ties into the law of unintended consequence. A lot of times, the way that politics shakes out yields a result that no one really wanted. I think we as humans are all compelled by stories of unintended consequence, right? Well, they gave the village a well and things were good for a while, but then the handle broke and no one knew how to fix it. And all the old wells, the hand-dug wells, had dried up, so they all died. Ooh, unintended consequence. Tell me about that. Seems like a wise statement about humanity itself. Which is like in politics. The districts, you see, got so gerrymandered that the incumbents were only worried about being outflanked to the right or left. Oh, yeah, that is a consequence of the ideological sorting. That is interesting. But this continuing resolution, this continuing resolution, this emergency resolution that is just regularly scheduled, it is not interesting. It's not even interesting as dysfunction. We've been there. We've done that. We've solved nothing. It's not a good story. It's not a good argument. It's not a surprise. Certainly not a good policy. Doesn't work for anyone. It sucks. I mean, it definitely sucks for all those poor kids who won't get CHIP. But I mean, for you and me and people paying attention, even for the jerks who we disagree with on 99% of the policies, they don't like it either. It's like basketball when the game is just the referee calling fouls and guys going one-on-one and missing shots. Or mid-career Costner. You know, the postman. Jesus, if that's what movies are, then I'm out. If this is what politics is, I can't take it. Can we get back at least to things like, I'm not even going to say some bill that helps people. Can we just get back to releasing the Fusion GPS transcripts or blaming the Congressional Budget Office for cooking the books or coming to within a vote of eradicating Obamacare? I mean, all of those things, in one way or another, represent some sort of horrific development, but at least they're interesting. Please, politics, interest me again. And that's it for today's show that just was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé. Not a fan of Mag's boot. He likes Optimum sandals. Mary Wilson, just senior producer. She adheres to the teachings of top-notch mule. Steve Lichtai, executive producer of Slate Podcasts, is obsessed with the concept of peak croc. And I do believe we've reached it. The gist. Trying to break through that espadrille ceiling you hear so much about. Oomperu, depuru, dupuru, and thanks for listening.